Today in prison, by tacit agreement, they will sing just one song, Nkosi Sikilela. Slowly and solemnly, with suppressed passion and pent-up feeling. The voices strong and steady, but with tears close and sharp behind the eyes, and the mind ranging wildly as a strayed bird, seeking some names to settle on, and deeds being done, and those who will do the much that still needs to be done.
We'll be able to hear some more of your poetry later on in this hour, but perhaps right now, Dennis, you should tell us the status of your visa request and of the deportation order.
Yes. Well, I went into court on November 10th, and the immigration judge found that I was deportable, which means I can expect to be deported at any time. We did, however, ask for a continuance, and so I go back to court in Chicago on January 14, where, as far as I can figure it out, the court will expect me simply to choose where I want to be deported to, and they're assuming that will be the end of the matter. But we will probably argue that I would leave the country voluntarily if I had the assurance that I would be allowed to return, that there is no need to deport me. And we will try to get that assurance. Failing that, we will ask the judge to rule that I be allowed to remain in the country and acquire permanent residence without leaving the United States. But we can't predict the outcome at this stage.
Why do you think that the American government wants to deport you after you've lived here for 10 years?
Well, the reasons given are fairly straightforward in the sense that they simply say that my visa expired and I remained here after that date. And that seems quite simple, but in fact, I notified the immigration officers that I would be reapplying for a visa, that I was unable to apply in time because the British government had cancelled my British passport and instructed me to get a Zimbabwe passport, and this took some time. And I then contacted immigration, told them of my predicament, and they said, no problem. When you get your new passport, go ahead and apply. So it seems to me unreasonable when they themselves assured me that the matter could be solved. So I must confess that I suspect there are political reasons rather than these straightforward bureaucratic reasons, because in many cases when people have applied late, the immigration has said, you shouldn't do this, but we'll fix it up anyway. And they do seem to be making an exception in my case.
Do you think the South African government has requested to have you deported?
I'm cautious about that. I do know that on one occasion when I was invited to lecture in Australia, the South African government asked the Australian government not to admit me. And someone in the civil service leaked this letter to the press, so the story came out in the Sydney newspapers the day I arrived there. We also know that the South African secret police has been in touch with U.S. immigration in the past, because a defector from the South African secret police has published a book in London. It's called Inside Boss. That's the name of the South African secret police, Bureau of State Security. And in it, this man, Gordon Winter, reports that he prepared a file on me for the South African secret police and then turned it over to the American Embassy in London. So we know there have been contacts, but I would be cautious to, there's not enough evidence to say that there has been a request on this occasion.
Can you think of anything that that you might have done within the last few years? Have you perhaps escalated your political activity? Something that would give a reason for someone to want you deported now, whereas you'd been left for 10 years to live peaceably in the United States?
Well, I think there's been a change, but it hasn't been in me. I think the pattern of my behavior has been very consistent ever since I left South Africa as an exile in 1966. I worked in Britain, I've lectured in France and Germany, in Australia, New Zealand, India, and in the United States. And the pattern has been fairly consistent. There hasn't been an increase nor a decrease. But I think the change has been in the United States. I think we have an administration now, under the Reagan presidency, far more friendly to South Africa. In fact, President Reagan, when he was interviewed by Walter Cronkite, said bluntly that South Africa would be treated as an ally. We've had the South African Foreign Minister, Roelof Botha, meeting with Alexander Haig, and then meeting with President Reagan in the White House. We've had Jean Kirkpatrick, the U.S. ambassador, meeting with the head of South African military intelligence. And perhaps most significantly, we now have South African military personnel training in the United States. We've had nuclear experts from the U.S. go to South Africa, and the supply of enriched uranium to South Africa. So that I think the climate is changing, and that things that I did in the past, which were tolerated at best, but are now regarded with more hostility.
Do you find it ironic that at this very moment when the United States is welcoming with open arms political refugees from Poland, at the same time are pushing someone like you, who's been here for 10 years, out the back door?
Oh, I think that's just one of those curious contradictions. There's an even more striking one. We had a South African rugby team which went to New Zealand. When they got there, over 100,000 people marched in protest. The team came to this country at a time when the South African rugby team literally has nowhere to go. They are excluded from pretty much every other country in the world, but they are welcomed here in the United States. And this at the same time when I am, in a sense, being punished for the success of my work in getting South Africa expelled from the Olympic Games. Some time ago, they brought a women's tennis team to Philadelphia. They played at the Spectrum. That team has now been expelled from world tennis. The men's team played down in Nashville, and then they were expelled from the International Tennis Association. So while South Africa is being isolated all over the world because of their racism, the United States is reversing that trend by making them welcome here. And at the same time, those who were instrumental in creating the isolation apparently are going to be punished for it.
I'd like to ask you a little more about the South African teams coming to the United States. I think that many people in this country who would say they were, certainly didn't believe in apartheid, you know, certainly didn't believe in racism, but feel that sports is something that should be not be sullied by contact with political causes.
Yes, indeed. I'm sure there are many who do. I think the number must be considerably fewer in the United States since 1980, because there you had a very striking example of the United States itself introducing politics into sport. The boycott of the Moscow Olympics was not because of anything in sport. It was because of what the Russians were doing in Afghanistan, and that was clearly a political issue. But I'm willing to go along with the people who say keep sport and politics separate. And I think that would be the ideal situation. The important thing to note here is that South Africa is guilty of introducing politics into sport. The government says that black and white may not play together. That's a political decision. But when it affects the selection of the Olympic team, so that you have a sports team from which blacks are excluded, even when they are the best in the country, then it seems to me this is a clear example of a country importing its politics and bringing it onto the sports field and saying, we have a certain political policy which we apply to our sports teams, and therefore they are in violation of the Olympic Charter. The Charter says that any country guilty of discrimination on the grounds of race or religion or politics must be excluded. And that's why South Africa has been expelled. We did not rely on the argument that there were people suffering in the ghettos of South Africa or people in the prisons of South Africa. We stuck to the sport situation. We demonstrated that some of the best athletes were black and they were being kept off the team entirely because of their color. And it was on that basis that we won. We said South Africa is guilty of injecting racist politics into sport. And until that racism is removed, South Africa should be expelled. And of course they were.
It was your work in South Africa trying to open up the South African Olympic teams to black athletes that first brought you to the attention of the South African government?
I think I was responsible for several things in different fields, but it's true that the sports one was the one they felt most strongly about. It made them very mad, especially as one had all the evidence. Because the officials, the president of the South African Olympic Committee, was saying, oh, sure, we don't care how good the blacks are. We don't want them on the team. The minister for sport in the government said that what the world must understand is that the selection of our teams has got nothing to do with proficiency. We're not interested in standards. We're interested in color. So using their own statements, I was able to prove the racism. But I had been active in attacking racism in housing, the segregated education for black and white. I had helped to organize a movement to start a new constitution for South Africa, which would remove all the laws that discriminated against people on the basis of race or color. And so I had a lot against me. I was also banned from writing. As a journalist, I tried to earn a living, and I was critical of the government and so. But I was, in fact, arrested in the offices of the South African Olympic Committee. So it was clear proof that of all the things I did, this one was the one they found most offensive.
After your arrest, you tried to escape to Germany?
Yes. I didn't really care where I got to, but at that time the Olympic Committee, the World Olympic Committee, was due to meet in Germany to discuss the South African issue. And I thought that it would, since I was in danger of going to prison, I would be more useful if I could get to Germany and attend the meeting. I actually got out of South Africa. I got into Swaziland and went from Swaziland to Mozambique, and was arrested there by the Portuguese secret police. And they then returned me to the South African secret police and took me to Johannesburg. Then I escaped a second time, and this time I was shot in the back by a member of the secret police, and then went to prison after that.
There's, I don't know if tradition is the right word, but well, a conception of, first, of prison as a crucible for people that brings perhaps emotions and ideas to the surface within a very brief time that someone who had not gone through that experience would have perhaps taken years to realize otherwise. And the tradition, I guess, is of prison creating an artist, prison, you know, letters from prison, like your book of poetry, Letters to Martha, and prison as a cradle for revolutionaries. Was that part of your experience on Robben's Island?
I think all of that is true, and I think those were some of the elements, but that was not the way it presented itself to me. I remember as a boy going to school, attending high school, I had to pass a prison each day going to and from school. And the prisoners were not kept on the first floor. It was a kind of basement. So you walked over cells as you walked on the sidewalk, and you could see the metal grill and the thick glass, and you knew there were people underneath there. And I think the idea came to me in a kind of schoolboyish way that you would not really understand the suffering of other people if you didn't share it yourself. But that just kind of lingered in my mind. But once I became politically active, I knew that it was inevitable that I would be caught at some point, arrested and jailed. In fact, I was active for 11 years before I was finally jailed. And I remember thinking to myself, well, 11 years is not a bad period. If you can go for 11 years, you've done pretty well. But I remember a priest saying to me, after I'd been arrested, he said, you know, it's almost like being in a monastery. You'll have a cell to yourself. And of course there's some validity to that notion as well. I think particularly once I was put in solitary, I felt I wanted to use my time in prison intelligently. To achieve a better understanding of myself, since you have all those hours of idleness on your hands and you're not allowed to read in a South African prison or to study or to write. And in fact, you have to keep busy simply to retain your sanity, because there's a danger in isolation. I'm not sure whether, in fact, the prison experience was a crucible for me in the sense of sharpening my commitment. But I did assume that I would probably die in prison because so many people just don't come out of a South African prison. So I spent some time thinking what I would do if I ever did come out of prison in a kind of speculative way. And I thought that the most useful thing to do would be to travel as much as possible and to speak to as many people as possible and communicate to them something of the quality of the South African experience in the hope that once they had a better understanding, they would be moved to do something about it. That seems to me especially true of Britain and the United States, the two countries which make the most money out of South African oppression. The British investment in South African gold mines and the diamond mines is enormous. The United States has over 300 corporations. There's $6.5 billion of American money now in South Africa. And that money makes a handsome return, and for a very good reason, that the blacks are so oppressed and so badly paid and are denied the political rights and the trade union rights, so that you can underpay them, you can pay them starvation wages, you can make a big profit. All of this is dependent on the system they call apartheid, the system of racist oppression. And I would like to believe that as more people know about it, their consciences will be stirred. And I also think it's a stupid thing to do, because what is happening is that the United States, for instance, is forming an alliance with less than 20% of the South African population and building up a vast reservoir of anger and resentment in more than 80% of the people. And so it seems to me to say that the United States must be in there to stop communism from taking over, for instance. It's sheer nonsense. On the contrary, if the United States goes on supporting the oppressor, most of the oppressed people will regard the United States as their enemy.
As we said before, though many Americans would certainly never think of themselves as supporting apartheid, they're not really sure what they should do or what they can do, and there's a lot of confusion over the proper way to deal with certain issues. A few years ago, there was an attempt by a group of people to organize a boycott of American industries that had plants in South Africa. Some people said, yes, you should absolutely boycott the country and try and destroy the South African economy. Other people said no, because there's, as in the United States, a very high rate of unemployment among blacks in South Africa. And even if it is a South African-supported plant, it's still a job, which is better than nothing at all.
Well, it seems to me, if one chose a crude image, the picture is really of one man sitting on top of another man, beating him on the head with a hammer, and someone comes by and debates, well, now, should we or should we not intervene? No one disputes the oppression in South Africa. Indeed, most of those who invest in South Africa begin by saying, oh, we abhor the system. We think it's terrible. And that, to me, is gross hypocrisy. Since the system is so profitable, it seems to me their real concern is the retention of those profits and the protection of those profits. And in the meantime, they can go around saying, what should we do about those poor blacks? If you ask the blacks would say, get out of here. Get off our backs. And if you really care about us, you'd stop profiting from our suffering. So it seems to me a gross misrepresentation and a kind of obfuscation. You confuse people. And, of course, some of that actually began here in Philadelphia, and it's something we must very much regret. The whole Leon Sullivan's arguments, the so-called Sullivan principles, that the corporations were in there doing good for the blacks. Far from it. Sullivan himself, by mid-1981, when he went to South Africa, came back to report that even those corporations that had signed the Sullivan Principles had done very little to improve the economic condition of the blacks. And even if they had, this is even more important, the Sullivan Principles are not aimed at improving political conditions for the blacks. Every black man and every black woman in South Africa cannot vote. And the Sullivan Principles do not in any way touch the issue of the vote. But I'm very encouraged to notice that in December, the University of Pennsylvania, which has a considerable investment in South Africa, their council met and by a large majority voted to divest from South Africa, to sell all the stocks and shares they have in South Africa. Of course, that's only one stage of the battle, and the next stage is the decisive one when the matter goes before the trustees. And it's fairly safe to predict that the trustees will oppose selling their stocks in South Africa. They'll come up with all kinds of sanctimonious reasons. But indeed, most of them tend to be also directors of banks and corporations that already have a large stake in the apartheid system. So even while they pretend as trustees of the university to be impartial and to take a judicial position, they're not really impartial because they're in the position of someone already implicated or an accomplice in the crime who now is being asked to sit in judgment. It's a little like asking the mafia to investigate casinos and gambling places. We can't rely on their judgment. And indeed, the one man whom they relied on in the past, Leon Sullivan, to give them a rationale, a kind of fig leaf to cover the obscenity of their presence in South Africa, even Sullivan is now retreating from his own principles.
Do you hope someday to live freely in South Africa? Do you think that that's really possible?
Yes, I do. And I would like to believe that what I'm doing, both speaking and writing, organizing, that all those things contribute to bringing about change in South Africa. I would like to believe that I will go back there and live as a free person in a free society, preferably as a poet and a writer. At present, it is a crime for anyone to read my poetry in South Africa or to possess it. But I'm hoping that the time will come when that is possible.
Many of your poems are very concerned with the physical aspects of nature, with the changing of the seasons, with flowers, all of which things I would think to you must mean South Africa. And I wonder if this is not too intrusive of a question, but if you're not beset with a kind of physical homesickness for the land of South Africa, besides the friends and the people that you left behind.
Yes, I think that's true. You're probably right in saying it's the kind of question one is a little cautious about examining too closely. In that sense, I almost retreat from the question. But it is true that the landscape that is in my poetry and the landscape that I talk about most of the time is that of South Africa. But the fact is that wherever one is, you can encounter things which simply evoke images of South Africa. When I was in India some time ago, I had tea with Mrs. Gandhi, and she asked whether I had been to the Taj Mahal, and I said no, and she was quite indignant and arranged for me to go there. But when I went to the Taj, apart from the beauty of it, I was very aware of the fact that it had been created as a tomb for a woman who the Shah Jahan had loved, but that he had planned the tomb while he had himself been driven into exile and returned after 8 years to build the tomb. And so I wrote a bit of poetry which is about the Taj Mahal in an oblique way, but it is more about what one can do in building your determination in exile. I'd like to read it. It's very brief. 8 years in exile, and the years kneaded from the bruised and quivering mind, such ardor and such sensitivity. A long agony of passion banked a great furnace of resolve that wrought stone dream and marble flower. 8 years.
Thank you for reading that. Would you like to read another poem?
Well, I was thinking of one, if I could find it, which also talks about the way one sees a natural landscape elsewhere, but it evokes a South African landscape instead. This one is not particularly appropriate, but I said earlier that wherever you are in exile, you could get evocations or echoes of things elsewhere. This one I wrote in a London suburb called Finchley when I was living there, and it's really about the people in prison on Robben Island, where I broke stones for some time. I walk in the English quicksilver dusk and spread my hands to the soft spring rain and see the streetlights gild the flowering trees and the late light breaking through patches of broken cloud. And I think of the island's desolate dusks and the swish of the island's haunting rain and the desperate frenzy straining our prisoned breasts and the men who are still there crouching now in the grey cells, on the grey floors, stubborn and bowed.
One aspect of your political poems, your more political poems, that's surprising to me and probably to a lot of people, is that although there's certainly a lot of anger and a lot of rage, there's frequently also an attempt to understand the people that are oppressing you, to empathize with them, to try and conceive how they as human beings have gotten to the point that they can oppress someone else.
Yes, I'm not quite sure how one arrives at that. I don't know what the kind of temperament or frame of mind is that generates that. If I were to make a stab at it and attempt to guess, one of the things you inherit in a British colony, as South Africa was, is the British notion of fair play, of fairness, and that, of course, dominated my thinking in sport. It was what made me mad when I heard that blacks were kept out, even if they were the best, because they were black. That seemed to me grossly unfair. But at the same time, I tried to be fair even towards the oppressor and try to understand what made him or her the way they were. And so I understood some of their fear and also the temptation to abuse power when you have it and how easily power can corrupt. But I think that's true, and sometimes people become impatient and say you really should get much more angry, you know. But I think this is a more balanced approach, and it's also the one that's, for me, more honest.
Did you always feel like that, or did you have to arrive at that point?
Well, I remember a period in prison when I was being kept in solitary, when I was very angry, and really would have countenanced any kind of destructiveness just in order to get out of prison. But I think generally I've attempted to see both sides of a question.
You also write a lot about two different qualities, the quality of loneliness, of being lonely and being alone, and with a little bit of mixed emotions maybe about endurance. One of your books is called Stubborn Hope, and they're both qualities that are felt by athletes, I think, and by people working for political causes.
I think that's a very astute comment. I think it's true. And, of course, very often I'll write about endurance in a kind of questioning way. I'll say, what's the point of enduring? You know, what does it achieve? But I remember as a young man, when I became involved in politics for the very first time, I had a friend, an older man, with whom I played chess every Sunday afternoon. And I remember he said to me on the first occasion, he said, I saw you active at a political meeting this week and you seem to do pretty well. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, the question is, do you have the stamina to keep going? And I thought that was a very shrewd remark, and I've often borne it in mind that it's easy to be politically active for a short while and then chuck it up and become bored. I think the real test is stamina, and that kind of stamina is applicable both to the athlete and the activist.
You're probably often referred to as an African poet. Does that phrase mean anything?
I'm not sure, and I think it's an interesting question. African in the sense of being born there, yes. African in the sense that my material comes from an African landscape, yes. I suppose so, and I teach, as you know, African literature, the poetry of Africans writing in Zulu or Xhosa or Sotho, as well as those writing in English and French. Perhaps no more than a Brodsky or a poet from Russia or France or Germany. Certainly we write in the English tradition, and people like John Donne influenced my own work a good deal. So did, say, Browning or Yeats. But I guess I'm quite satisfied to be listed with the African poets, and I think there's some truth in the term.
Do you think there can be some essential quality that marks someone as being African that people who are African share?
Again, that would be tricky. I think it's true that the African poets I know, well, we share tradition, for instance, which is not too unlike a Western tradition, but a tradition which I think is often lost sight of in the West. The African poet was always part of the community and spoke to his community and drew his inspiration from the community. And this, among other things, meant that he was always involved in the political and social life of that community. He functioned often as a satirist. He would poke fun at the political figures. He would make them look silly and stupid. And he would also be the one who would chronicle the achievements of the community and record their history. So he had a very useful function in the community, and he was honored for it, male or female. So certainly I think African writers tend to be more committed, and because that's their tradition. In the West you might choose to be committed or dilettante, if you wish to. But otherwise, I think it depends on what part of Africa you come from, what kind of landscape you reflect. And since I grew up in a ghetto, and the landscape I knew was one in which there was constant police raids, police brutality, racism, to be honest, that's the landscape I must reflect in my work.
Some Western black activists, I think, have a rather romantic idea of Africa, of the concept of Africa as a continent, African history, the glorious older days, and perhaps a utopian ideal that maybe isn't that true to what's really there.
Yes, but I suspect that's true of the West too. You know, one tends to suppress what is unpleasant and to remember all the nice things. Indeed, Western history seems to be a long chronicle of wars, and wars always mean people getting killed. So even that's not particularly glorious. But it's true that if you are of African descent but have grown up somewhere in the diaspora, whether it's in the Caribbean or in America, you tend to romanticize. I think that's true. But no more so than elsewhere. And of course, in the case of Africa, our problem is that too much of Africa has been treated as primitive and brutal and backward, when there's so much that is rich and cultured and beautiful.
Perhaps we would have time to read one or two more poems, if you have one that you'd like to read.
Yeah, one of those, there is one which refers to one of the comments you made a little earlier, which I might read. The whole notion in South Africa of understanding the white oppressor, the racist oppressor, and how his mind works. This one is perhaps less sympathetic towards them because I'm seeing them by an ironic reversal as the more primitive in their anxiety to protect their privilege. They become more desperate and more primitive. And each year in December, they have a special festival in South Africa. It's a public holiday when they celebrate their victory over the blacks at a place which is now called Blood River, because so many died that the water turned to blood. It's just stained red. And this is a poem I wrote about it. Each year on this day, they drum the earth with their boots and growl incantations to evoke the smell of blood, for which they hungrily sniff the air. Guilt drives them to the lair of primitiveness and ferocity. But in the dusk, it is the all-pervasive smell of dust, the good smell of the earth as the rain sifts down on the hot sand that comes to me, the good smell of the dust that is the same everywhere around the earth. And there are others along that line which look at some aspects of the behavior of the oppressor. This is the last one in a collection which is called A Simple Lust, and the title is taken from this particular poem. A simple lust is all my woe. The thin thread of agony that runs through the reins after the flesh is overspent in overtaxing acts of love. Only I speak the other's woe. Those congealed in concrete or rotting in rusted ghetto shacks. Only I speak their wordless woe, their unarticulated simple lust.
Dennis, thank you so much for reading for us and for coming by today and joining us here in the interview.
Thank you.